Welcome, fellow Wi-Fi pioneers. This is episode 3 of the Wi-Fi Pioneers podcast, and we are your hosts, Colt and Remington. Say hi, Remy.
Hey, what's up, guys?
All right. Last episode, we were going to talk about some housing investment stuff, and we went on a lot of tangents and never made it. So we're going to start right with that today, going right into it with, is housing even a good investment, and what are some of the things you need to look for? So why don't you just start on this, Remy, because you've got a lot more commentary and experience in this than I do.
I think we've been sold the story, which is that everybody should be a homeowner. And the federal government gives you lots of ways to do that, or it gives you lots of incentives to do that. And the idea is that homeownership is a great investment. But the simple fact is, it's not always a great investment. In fact, a home itself, not the land, but the home itself is, you know, depreciable, at least if you have a multifamily home. I mean, the IRS says you can depreciate that over 27 and a half years. So that gives you an idea what the IRS thinks the useful life of those buildings is. But the main idea is home ownership is more about lifestyle than an investment. The reason that people think it's a good investment right now, or at least people raised in the last four decades have been taught to think it's a great investment, is that homeownership has generally benefited from a decreasing interest rate regime. So, you know, a dollar can buy you more home with lower interest rates. And then, of course, with the fact that the U.S. has these incredible guaranteed 30-year fixed rate mortgages, it just makes homeownership really, really easy. But that doesn't mean it's a great investment. That doesn't change the real fundamentals of the homeownership. It just makes it easier to pay for. So if you actually track the money that goes into your home, like you would a business, if you don't happen to have an investment property, it turns out, especially because it's personal property, it turns out that, it's actually a really bad return. Your money's better spent lots of other places. So I'm personally a big fan of taking as much debt as you can on your, of course, not financial advice. Don't sue me. Taking as much debt as you can on your primary mortgage, on your primary home, so that you can use that cash elsewhere. So, for example, on your Wi-Fi business, or to invest in somebody else's business, or to save in, you know, some sort of good hard money, right?
Let me jump in real quick on that, though, because a lot of people misunderstand what that winds up meaning. I think I get a good idea of what you mean by taking on as much debt as you can, but that people take that literally. You got to remember, when it comes to the internet, especially, everything is extremes and absolutes. So when you say something like take on as much debt as you can, people are thinking, well, what's the minimum payment I can make every month? What's the highest possible minimum payment? That's not what we're talking about here. It's, you know, what is the minimum payment you can sustain before it becomes a burden to you? You know, if your payment is 50% of your income, you are way over leveraged in your house. So I'll use my own home as an example, because I was able to buy mine just at the very end of those sub 3% mortgage rates. I bought a house that's probably one third the size of what my income normally gets. It's actually such a smaller house that the mortgage company made us write a letter explaining why we were buying such a small house at our income. It totally baffled them. But it's because it was the best trade-off of, you know, leveraging debt. Our payment is so low, it will be inflated away, but it's a low payment to begin with. So we put, you know, we did a almost zero down payment on the house, but our payment is very tiny, especially for the area and especially for our income. It's, you know, it takes 1 to 2 days of Wi-Fi work for me to make my mortgage payment. So is that more in line of what you're talking about with taking as much debt, taking on debt that so you can use the rest for a better investment?
Yeah. So I'm definitely not saying buy as much house as you possibly can. I think that's a terrible idea.
Okay.
Buy the right house for your lifestyle that's sustainable over, you know, long-term business cycles, that you can endure an adverse event or two or five and not lose your house. But if you're going to buy, take advantage of the mortgage rate structure, especially because, and this, now I have to caveat, some of what I'm about to say varies by state. So some states give you really preferential treatment because they have non-recourse mortgages, meaning if you default, the bank can only take the house. They can't come after you personally for the remainder if there's a shortfall. So let's say you owe $300,000 on a mortgage and they sell the house, or they foreclose on you and they take the house, and the house only gets them $250K. They can't come after you for the other $50K. And in that case, I believe when it's non-recourse debt, the IRS says that that transaction is considered a sale. So you sold the house to the bank at whatever the principal remaining on your mortgage was, and free and clear, everything, you just walk away. So no 1099C with phantom income, nothing like that. Now, granted, that varies by state. Some states, you could end up with that 1099C, and it, although, you know, with the 2007, 2008 mortgage crisis, and since then, Congress has passed a couple measures to help kind of ease that burden if it's your primary residence. But there's some dollar thresholds. I think back in the day it was 2 million. Now it's like 750,000, and some very important caveats you got to meet for them to not give you that phantom income, 1099C. If you end up walking away from a house and the foreclosure doesn't cover your mortgage, or at least the principal on your mortgage. So some caveats there, but generally speaking, buy a house that sustains your lifestyle, but recognize homeownership is a lifestyle investment. It's not a financial investment. If you happen to catch a bull market in a region or a city that's really good, awesome. But nationwide, probably not the case, right? There were plenty of places to lose money over the last decade or two by buying a house. It's a personal investment or personal lifestyle decision, a personal lifestyle investment. Don't overdo it. It's more like a car, right? But it's not a typical investment the way people think of investments.
Well, that's, you know, a lot of people don't have the long-term memory. They have, history began in 2020 when housing prices just shot through the roof. So there's no memory of, the housing crash in 2008 that kicked off the Great Recession. There's no memory of mortgages being, this is the highest mortgages have been in 20 or 30 years. When I bought my first house, I was at 6.5%, which a year ago was an outrageous interest rate. But when I got it, my father, he was just baffled at such a low interest rate, because his interest rate was like 12%. So, the further you go back, these things were very over, the mortgage rates were very high, the pricing was very different, and the last couple of years really throws off all the long-term charts, and it looks like we're kind of going back to a more historical norm. Prices will probably come down to catch up, but the interest rates are going to go back up as well, and we're going to see the next couple of years is really going to make people feel silly for not, definitely make feel silly for not refinancing when they have those 3% rates available.
Yeah, so great point. That interest rate structure, the mortgage debt, if you're in a low interest rate regime and you have the ability to walk away from a house without having them come after you with a 1099C, or you don't have to put down much equity to get into it, there's some ways to get in there where you're not having a lot of downside, right? Again, not financial advice. Don't sue me. Yeah. It's sometimes the bank does not require you to have a lot of skin in the game. And if you're in a situation where you're in a runaway market and you're worried that you're not going to be able to get in, and the market's just going to leave you behind because interest rates are so ridiculously low, there may be some ways to do that, right? Especially if you're considered a first-time home buyer, whatever the definition of that is, or you have, some of these preferential loan products like a VA loan or something like that with a low down payment. You can get in without having a ton of equity in the house. And then, you're not on the hook for that much equity lost if interest rates jump, 100%, and now your home is worth a third of what it was before.
Yeah, and a lot of people are going to be facing that. Some people might already be facing that, but by this time next year, they're definitely going to be facing that as 2023 rolls around and we have 8-9% mortgage rates. That's a lot of people who bought $600,000 homes are going to be in for a rude awakening.
Yeah, the beauty of that is they sort of allow you to, with U.S. mortgage rate structures, they allow you to sort of match term fund the asset, right? And that's kind of a corporate finance term, but essentially it means you're structuring debt to be coterminous with your planned ownership of the property. So like, let's say it's 30 years. That means that if there's a significant change in the cost of capital, then the cost of your debt sort of moves with the cost of the asset. So hopefully you can be protected kind of there. But again, I would caution people not to get too deep into that stuff, because if you don't know what you're doing, you can easily get upside down or get something wrong. And then now you're in pain with your, you know, with your family's primary residence. And you're like, gosh, I can't believe those guys told me to do this. But the main point is your primary residence is a lifestyle investment. Don't overdo it. And if you get in and it's a crazy market, research some of the ways to protect yourself so that it's the bank who's taking all the risk and not you. Remember, banks love blowing money. They love it. So if they're willing to stick their neck out and help you out, take advantage of that. Now, if you have real estate as an investment, so not your primary home or anything like that, not a second home, and you can treat it as a business, now you can start depreciating things. Now you can take other write-offs. There's some tax advantages there, maybe even tax shelters. That's a whole different situation than your primary residence. I'm speaking primarily about your primary residence. You can't depreciate it. You can't, there's a lot of upkeep costs to it, right? Anyway, that's it.
Okay. What is your opinion then on actually taking properties as a, for rental income and passive income versus using that in a Wi-Fi business or just the stock market itself? I mean, do you really see good returns on investment there? And what is your take?
In general terms, real estate, there's two ways to make money in real estate. It's an incredibly levered investment on the upside. So if you catch a bull market, great. You can turn, you know, a little bit of money into a lot of money because the banks let you leverage them so highly. And if you happen to catch, say, a good cash flowing property in a high interest rate environment and it transitions to a low interest rate environment, the value of your property just went up substantially. The other thing is special situations, right? So let's say you just happen to know that everybody and their dog is going to move to a particular city. That might be a good excuse to buy some commercial real estate or some residential real estate. If you're able to get in at a decent price and you can catch the upside or at least cash flow until there's an upside. The other part of special circumstances is what drives a lot of value in real estate. Well, I should say the opposite, actually. What destroys a lot of value in real estate is just cash flow constraints. So I watch this all the time with major real estate shops. Like, you blow your mind how much of value they destroy, because they don't manage their cash flows properly. They'll buy a single tenant warehouse with, a long-term lease on it, but from a business that fails in 3 years and has a lot of tenant specific improvements in that building. And now they're sitting on a quagmire that requires a whole bunch of work to even make it suitable for another tenant. So now you're not cash flowing anymore. You've got this ridiculous mortgage to pay and you've got to put more cash in it just to turn the building over. I've watched incredibly quote unquote sophisticated real estate firms just blow a shit ton of money on that. And then all somebody had to do to turn it around was come in, add some cash flow, maybe redo the asphalt, the parking lot. I should say add some cash flow, put some cash in to turn the property over, put a tenant in. And now all of a sudden they've got a good cash flowing asset again that's worth three or four times what they bought it for because the company before them ran into problems and had to liquidate. So I would say those two circumstances are where I would identify good opportunities in real estate. One is you know of a particularly good, strong regional or local market, and you're willing to take a bet on it. You can time it well, get in at a reasonable basis, and possibly, you know, harvest of a decreasing interest rate environment. Or two, if you know of a particular asset that's being disposed of, it's fire sale prices because some idiot didn't manage their cash flows. I think in real estate, they always say, there are two kinds of people who make money in real estate. One is a person who takes all the debt, and then the other person is who takes no debt. And it's because the person who takes all the debt sets aside a whole bunch of cash for a rainy day, and they can endure the ups and downs. Person who takes no debt has no worry about someone coming and taking the property from them. So they only need a tiny bit of cash flow to stay in the property. It's all the people in between who take some debt, take a lot of debt, don't set aside cash to be able to sustain the ups and downs. They lose their ass in real estate. It's ridiculous. Anyway, that's it.
Well, so it wasn't with commercial real estate, but I off and on over the last 15 years, I've had rental properties. Some worked out well for me and some were absolute disasters. I definitely had a very painful learning curve, and it was all self-induced. But in one case, I bought a house in late 2007. So you can guess what happened next. You know, 2008 rolls around and the value of my house dropped by about, I don't know, 30-40% with overnight, and over the next 4 years, it dropped almost 50% in value total. And it wasn't just that. It was that my mortgage was still, the mortgage payment I had to make was from 2007 at the top of the market. I couldn't have possibly gotten a higher price for the house. Like I bought at the absolute worst time, but post crash and now going into that recession, rental prices themselves could not, the average rental price in my city was less than my mortgage. So I was upside down a couple $100s every month that I had to shell out myself because I couldn't actually rent at the mortgage rate. Like this was just a nightmare scenario for me. And because of the fact that I was in the military at the time, I couldn't allow myself to go bankrupt on the house or have it repossessed or anything of that nature because I'd have lost my security clearance. Like, so I was just fucked. And it was about the worst possible scenario you could be in. I say worst possible scenario. And then a year later, my renter lost his job and started selling meth. So the worst possible scenario was narrowly avoided because he was selling meth in the road and not on the property. So when the SWAT team arrested him, my house didn't get seized as part of the drug making operation. Like I narrowly avoided that. So I almost had the worst case scenario.
Fantastic set of criteria to dissuade somebody from being a landlord. And I certainly have I don't have a disaster story about being a landlord, but I have zero interest in being a landlord again. Zero interest. I think that aside from the investment characteristics, obviously just the headache of being a landlord and dealing with crappy tenants and the people who are prone to rent, it's enough to drive you away. Plus all the ways that they impair the value of a home over time, like think of all the things that are underneath the carpet or all the problems that they seed into that house that you're going to find later. And you're going to be like, man, I did not budget for that. I just like renters do not take care of a property. They beat it up.
And to some degree, that's always been the case. But in the last 10 years, there's been this real shift of entitlement culture in America where, you know, nothing is your fault. You have no responsibility to yourself. You have no responsibility to other people. So the rental culture has degraded from what it was 20, 30, 40 years ago to where they absolutely wreck homes. So when we're talking about homeownership as a lifestyle choice a couple minutes ago, if you're a person who is a renter and you're leaving your rental property better than you moved into it, you should be a homeowner. That is, it's in your lifestyle to improve what's around you. Buy a house, make it yours. You'll be much happier and much more secure. But if you're a person who looks at your carpet and goes, screw it, it ain't mine, let the dog piss on it, never buy a home. Just be a renter forever and, you know, just stay there.
Yeah, definitely. The other big consideration is in the past, you know, having a second home to rent out to people or a small multifamily unit was considered a great way to have passive income. That's changing, especially with Wi-Fi money now, right? So if you can have Wi-Fi money, you've got really good residual income. Go ahead.
Yeah, let me interrupt you real quick. The other thing, in the post-COVID world, it is immensely harder in many states to evict people. In some states like California, they're starting to pass laws where you essentially just can't evict people. So they can just move in and stop paying. So there is no rental income. There is no passive income if your renter is not obligated to pay you. So that's really something to consider moving forward into the 2020s. And your state is, how hard is it to evict somebody? How many months can they go not paying before I can move them out? And how long is it going to take me to get a new renter in? Because that really changes the math. And that really should make you start thinking about Wi-Fi money and everything I just interrupted you on.
Definitely. In addition to all the requirements of being physically present or hiring a manager to run the property for you, there's just, it's not a low touch thing, right? It's a high touch thing. You've got to be really involved. There's lots of downsides. There's lots of misaligned incentives between the people running the property and you. It's way different than commercial real estate. Commercial real estate, people generally play by different rules. I just lost my point on the other thing I was going to say, but,
you're transitioning into with the advent of Wi-Fi money now and how easy it is to build a Wi-Fi business, why you really want to go that way versus the traditional passive income routes.
Yeah. So Wi-Fi business, I mean, the returns on a Wi-Fi business, even unlevered returns, I mean, blow away anything in real estate. Plus you are the key driver in your Wi-Fi business. Whereas in real estate, it's primarily market driven, national market and regional and local market. So you just hold so much more control over the outcome. And if you want to live around the world, right, you can with Wi-Fi business. So, it seems like people are going to be moving away from that. So lots of fundamentals against improvements in real estate pricing. I consider myself very bearish on residential real estate in particular. Because of, you know, the interest rate environment, because of all the things, like we have this entire economy built on monopoly money. And when that disappears, guess what? All these people with second homes, all these people with vacation homes, all these people with lots of rentals that no longer cash flow are going to get repossessed. I mean, there's just, I don't know anybody in any town who's not like, man, there's just building going on all over the place all the time. How are we using up all these houses? How's the inventory disappearing? It's gotta be going to secondary uses, tertiary uses. And then when those things are no longer carried by this sort of like cloud of monopoly money, that's going to come crashing down. And, I just don't see with the dollar and its long-term position in the world and the petrodollar system. I mean, there's just so much downside to it. So if you get in hedged, otherwise, man, Wi-Fi money, way, way better return for your time and lifestyle and downside protection.
So here's something else to consider with housing too. I don't know what your timeline of bearishness is, if you're just referring to the 2020s or even extending into the 2030s. But if you go way out over the next 20 to 40 years, we have a declining population in this nation. All Western nations do. And in fact, if it wasn't for immigration and the unreported illegal immigration, we'd already be negative in declining numbers. The actual native-born American population is already declining. So at some point, immigration is going to stop. Even immigration is going to slow down because those nations are facing negative birth rates as well. So it could be as soon as 20 years, but more likely 40 to 60 years, you're going to have more homes than you have people. Granted, a lot of the homes are going to be very old and not in good condition, but the fact remains is that there will be residential structures all over the country and not enough people to live in them. You know, it's really not unreasonable to think at some point you're going to have to buy one house, get your vacation home free sales. Like it sounds hyperbolic and ridiculous, and yet declining population could drive that.
Oh, I was going to ask you the scenario you laid out before where you had the SWAT team come and take your tenant. Did you have a personal guarantee on that mortgage?
Yeah, because it started out as a personal mortgage. Well, it was a personal mortgage that got turned into a rental property. So I didn't buy it as a rental property. I bought it as a primary home and then turned it into that when I moved out.
So did they have recourse to your personal balance sheet if you defaulted on the mortgage?
You know, I don't know. I can't give an answer. It was 15 years ago. I just don't remember.
Again, caveat, disclaimer, all this stuff, not financial advice, not legal advice, not tax advice, but it's highly dependent on what your state's mortgage structure is, whether it's whether it is a non-recourse state and whether you have to sign a personal guarantee on any sort of mortgage. And then whether it's your principal residence, those are the primary things that are going to determine a lot of what your downside scenario looks like. If you buy into a house, interest rates go up And now the value of your house drops significantly. You run into an adverse event, and now you have to liquidate the house or it gets taken away from you. Look into those things very carefully. And of course, I'm not telling people to go out and load up on debt, but I'm saying if you're going to buy an asset, especially in a highly volatile interest rate environment, match term funding is a great way to neutralize a lot of the risks as long as you have a way to hand over the property to the bank without suffering a tremendous amount of personal loss.
Can you just kind of explain what match term funding is?
Yeah. So when you arrange debt on a property that's roughly coterminous with the useful life of that property. So a counter example would be, I think in like the UK, I'm speculating a little bit, definitely Canada. If you buy a house, the mortgage you get on that house is not a 30-year mortgage. you have to refi every 5 or 10 years. I mean, you can sense the problem in that, right? Like, what if you buy a house and then 5 years later, the interest rate environment is terrible? Now you're in a situation where you might have to liquidate just because the mortgage forced you to. You didn't even suffer an adverse scenario. It's just the mortgage rates went up substantially. Now you can't afford the house anymore. That's not match term funding, right? You're planning to stay in that house a lot longer, and now you're having to refi it halfway through. It's kind of the personal finance equivalent of a lot of these corporations that fund their long-term assets with short-term commercial paper or short-term commercial notes. They have to go out into the capital markets frequently and raise money again. And so they're constantly playing the front end of the interest rate curve, and they can end up upside down on it.
Okay. When you mentioned Canada, that also reminded me too, a lot of people don't realize the only reason we're able to get away with a 30-year fixed rate mortgage of any percentage rate is because it's backed by the government. You know, in the European countries, you get a 60-year mortgage. And I don't know if it's variable or fixed, but you think about it, who's going to lend, especially when we're at 3-4% interest rates, who's going to lend a 30-year loan at 4% interest when that's going to be inflate that by the time you get to the end of that loan, you'll have lost money as the loan officer because of it be inflated into the negative. There's just no way for that to be sustainable in a free market environment at such low rates.
Yeah. And if you think about the structure of, you know, what you call Fannie and Freddie debt here in the States, if you're an investor and you're buying mortgage-backed securities, you're effectively taking an interest rate bet where if it moves against you, it moves hard, you lose a lot. If it moves to you, people refi and you lose the cash flow that you were counting on. Right? So you're effectively short a call option on the value of that bond if you consider it as buying a bond. So it's just mortgage debt is a really bizarre animal in the States. And I wouldn't be surprised, especially as like we get into a much more volatile interest rate environment. You know, we had massive, massive interest rate volatility recently in 2022. As we get into that kind of stuff, I mean, who's really going to want to hold mortgage debt? So watch those premiums jump up, because you're effectively short that call option on investing in that debt. If you're a mortgage rate buyer, a mortgage security buyer. So I think we're kind of like exiting a highly beneficial financing regime for mortgage rate financing regime in real estate. In addition to all the real factors we just talked about, like there's just so many other places to invest your time, especially if you want to have a lot of location freedom. There's so many other ways to, there's so many ways for real estate to move against you. There's so many ways the government is going to start holding it against you. There's so many ways for the government to get their hands on that money. Right. The easiest thing for them to get their hands on is real estate. Hard thing for them to get their hands on a lot of Wi-Fi money.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, how do you see Wi-Fi money is all in my head. I mean, you seize my website, I make a new one.
Yeah. Yeah. And especially if we're entering this regime where most of the traditional institutions and trust networks have eroded and are decrepit and falling apart. And you see some standing in like, you know, like Meta or Facebook and other, you know, web-based trust networks, but they're weak trust networks. And I forgot, there's a guy who's writing great stuff about this. I forgot his name at the moment, but that will eventually be replaced by strong trust networks. It just has to. There's just a vacuum right now. And once you reestablish strong trust networks, I think the Wi-Fi money network is going to become mainstream, and you're going to kick yourself for not having been in it.
Yeah. So I'm still trying to formulate this properly. So I'm just going to kind of work through it out loud, but so we're moving into the era of Wi-Fi money, and the value of the Wi-Fi money is becoming a lot more than IRL in real life money. You know, the value of your ability to, whether it's writing a book or writing a Substack or selling e-commerce, it's becoming more than mechanics and plumbers, like, because it scales, right? But in a very real sense, the physical work is still more important, but it doesn't scale properly, and it's being replaced by cheap, low-wage workers who quite honestly do a shit job, but they're so plentiful that the quality mechanics are getting run out of business by the cheap mechanics. And it's going to create a business opportunity for IRL money down the road. But in the short term, all the talent and skill is going to Wi-Fi money, and it's leaving a skills deficit in the real life labor market for any of the trades. But the trades are still more important. They're just not, ironically, they're not more valuable, but they are more important. Somebody has to make the food. Somebody has to build the house. Somebody has to fix the toilet. But the skill set required for that to do it shittily is a lot lower than it is for Wi-Fi money. And the skill set to do it really well is very high, and does not, the demand for the high skill is not there because the low skill is so much cheaper. But I guess what I'm getting at is 10, 15 years down the road, there's going to be a heavy demand for skilled, you know, in real life laborers, skilled tradesmen, more so than even now. So what's going to be the business opportunity on that end? How do you make that scalable to compete with Wi-Fi money so that we don't lose all the talent to Wi-Fi and then have nobody doing the physical work?
It might not happen for a while. do you ever just stop and talk to anybody who's got a brick and mortar business? They hate their life right now. It's so hard. They can't find employees. They can't pay their rent. It's ridiculous. And we haven't even entered, you know, the crash yet. So imagine all these retail shop owners, right? Imagine if you're, again, going back to real estate, if you own a retail property, man, I don't know what the long-term view is on that. If all this commerce is going online, how much are people actually doing in person anymore? I can't see the demand for office space going up substantially. I can't see the demand for retail space going up substantially. I just see lots of warehouses with drones delivering them, and all this commerce taking place online. So, man, you can see why I'm so bearish on real estate. It's everything is transitioning from brick and mortar to digits, and it's not the store of value that people have considered it to be in the past, especially because we had such a tremendous boom in interest rates. And over the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 years, you've got to imagine that the interest rate structures are going to be perpetually high.
Well, yeah, it's going to have to be. You can't contain how many trillions did we print in the last 2 years? You can't contain that overnight. And that's the thing. You can flood it into the market over the span of a year or two. But to contain the damage, for the damage to even take effect, takes a couple of years, as we're seeing. The inflation is just now kicking in from the 2020 money printer. But then to contain that money with the high interest rates is going to take, we don't know how long, but it's going to take a lot more time than anybody expects it to.
Yeah, as you're seeing the petrodollar system get displaced, and you're seeing a transition to a more multipolar world with Russia and China, just the worldwide demand for dollars decreases, and all these things that were artificially depressing our interest rate structure, Saudi money, et cetera, are all leaving. And so now we've way over indebted ourselves federally, even at all the corporates and then all the unfunded commitments, all the unfunded liabilities for the federal government. We're just bankrupt. And the only thing holding it together is that we're able to, right now, still force all these people to use the dollar. And granted, with high interest rates in the dollar, people are coming to the dollar as a store of value and vacating all the weaker related currencies. And you see those crash. But we just happen to be the high hill in the flood. but we don't realize the flood is going way higher than this hill. And yeah, if you don't vacate the dollar soon, you don't have some other good store of value, be up shit creek. And then in addition to that, I mean, sure, we're still going to have to pay a lot of things in dollars. So having Wi-Fi cash flows in dollars, really valuable.
Well, and the nice thing about Wi-Fi cash flows is that you can turn it into other currencies if you have to go somewhere else, assuming that your business is scalable in that direction. It's not, for the most part, most of these businesses can be taken with you overseas.
Yeah, as long as the capital controls haven't been implemented, right? So keep in mind, there's always that possibility. You know, in 2007, we had a bailout where the federal government came and bailed out all the banks. The next one is probably going to be a bail-in where they just freeze the off-ramps to take your money elsewhere. This happens, you know, in emerging markets all the time. And people in the U.S. can't contemplate it because we just haven't seen it in a long, long time. And so keep in mind that it could very easily turn into a situation where you're not allowed to take your money out of the U.S. banking system.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I'm not an expert on expatriation and going to other countries and whatnot. I know at some point we'll have a conversation about that kind of stuff, but that's really out of my wheelhouse. So I'm, you know, stuck with in U.S. solutions, but that kind of segues into another thing is, what do people do, right? So we've talked about, if you're going to buy a house, understand it's a lifestyle, it's not an investment. And also, you know, if you're going to leverage the debt, don't go insane. Don't get yourself a $600,000 house because you can make the payment right now. And I don't know who can make a payment on that right now with 8% interest. But the point is, make sure you're in a house that can sustain you for a few years minimum, but also that your payment can withstand the ups and downs of a turbulent economy. If you get laid off, you know, can you pick up a second job or a part-time job and still make your mortgage payment? So that's something you got to think about as you're buying right now, is, you know, 2, 3, 5 years from now, in an emergency situation, can I pay the mortgage for 6 months while I get back on my feet? Assuming you're not in a Wi-Fi business already and running your own business successfully already, you're just starting up. So that's kind of the first thing. But what do people do next as inflation's going up and employment's going down? How do people, as they start making their Wi-Fi money, what are some of the things you do with it, other than the obvious of reinvesting into your business? Just what are some things people should consider doing?
Yeah. So if I were starting a business that produced Wi-Fi money, and if I were doing something with that money, not telling anybody else what to do, hypothetically, I would personally be looking at gold and Bitcoin. Stores of value, decently hard money, and not blown out by the capital markets, right? Everything that you're looking at on the capital markets right now have just been inflated so ridiculously with all this monopoly money that eventually will come crashing down. It's like the best ways to save and store your accumulated wealth and all the things that you've, you know, put your blood, sweat, and tears into is your own business, your friend's business, if he's doing well, and gold and Bitcoin, right? Things that the government can't directly manipulate.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So, okay. But let me kind of run through the differences between those two, because there's timelines associated with that. Now, gold, the easiest way to oversimplify it is that gold does not go up in value. The dollar goes down in value. So all things being equal, which they're not, but all things being equal, if I have $1,000 and today I can buy 1,000 hamburgers with it, I buy $1,000 worth of gold. If we go through 20% inflation and that gold goes from $1,000 to $1,200, I could still buy 1,000 hamburgers with it, because it's a store of value. It didn't actually increase. It just, its purchasing power remains the same. It's just the dollar value associated appears to go up. Is that more or less a good summary of gold?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is a great time to point out the long running joke we have about all the things that outperformed the S&P 500.
Yes. Gold outperformed the S&P 500 by 0.1% over the last 20 years. That should tell you that that means that if you invested whatever amount of money 20 years ago in the S&P 500, you have the same purchasing power today.
So I think it's worthwhile just reflecting on that for a moment. And I have to say this as a person who did not understand gold until recently. Just, I was like, it doesn't do anything. It just sits there. Whereas, you know, even if a company, even if I'm buying at a high valuation over a long term, it's creating value and eventually that'll turn my way. But what that's saying is that the value of the S&P 500 is totally made up, right? It's not even keeping up with something that can't be very easily manipulated. So like it almost makes it sound like the U.S. corporate business hasn't even produced any value. And maybe there's some different interpretations there if you really want to get in the analytics and stuff. But just as a 10,000 foot view, the fact that a non-performing asset like gold can even keep pace with the S&P 500 over any sort of extended period tells you don't buy anything in the capital markets. Again, not financial advice. I'm just talking about what I do. But it just blows my mind that we're going to have that Wile E. Coyote moment where all of a sudden we look down and realize there's nothing underneath us. And we've just been standing on clouds for a long time. That's one of those things that really drives it home is when you just compare the S&P 500 to all these other things and you're like, oh wow, it was all made up.
Yeah. Well, now Bitcoin, I'm bullish on Bitcoin in the long term, but in the short term, you've got a lot of volatility with it. You know, 2 years ago, it was worth $60,000, or a year and a half ago, it was worth $60,000. Now it's worth like 20,000. Next week, it could be 25 or it could be 10. Bitcoin has not proven itself long term yet, right? Now, I said I'm bullish and I've got a lot of confidence that it will over the long haul, but there's a lot of hurdles it has to make. So if you've got $1,000 right now and you might need that $1,000 in the next year, I would think gold would be better than Bitcoin. Whereas if that $1,000 is something you don't have to rely on in the near future or even the mid future, you put it into Bitcoin, that's a much better investment potentially than things like the stock market or gold, because if it gets that adoption in the next decade and it becomes more mainstream, then its value shoots up. You know what? Again, that's a very oversimplified take on it, but what did I miss there?
I think that's a great way to start. It's again, we're not financial advisors, so there's some things to consider that we may not touch on. But certainly, from a volatility perspective, gold is much, much lower than Bitcoin. Bitcoin has, I think, a lot of advantages to gold, and there's some people who are really good at articulating all the reasons why. So obviously worthwhile doing some research there. In fact, it's worth saying again, Bitcoin is the one thing I found in life where every minute that I spent learning it was worth it, right? Even every minute that I still spend on it is worth it. Very few things like that. So just understand that it's not just a fad. It's not just some sort of weird millennial or Generation Z thing. There's real engineering behind it. And there's real properties that are important to understand. Once you do, it's freedom money. It's got some things that allow you more freedom than storing that money in gold. Certainly not just, in terms of portability, but also in terms of exchangeability and all these things. So well worth learning everything you can about Bitcoin. And, as you said, it's when you're thinking about how to store wealth for near-term expenses, obviously Bitcoin is probably not the place, right? There's nothing wrong with holding, like I think there's nothing wrong with holding a significant amount of US dollar cash as long as you've got it quote unquote sterilized by all these other hard monies, right? Gold and Bitcoin and you've got good cash flow coming in somewhere else. If we end up in a hyperinflationary environment, you're going to be okay, right? Whereas if you are all in these highly volatile currencies, I mean, that's kind of what they are because they're not directly exchanged in an economy yet. So they have a lot less direct linkages that stabilize their value. You could very easily, as we saw right now, like if you just took a 60% bath in Bitcoin, and you expected to use that money for something, ouch.
Yeah. And that's why it's like, you got to be willing to let go of that money for, I don't know the timeline. I'm gonna say a decade. That's where my headspace is at, but I could be wrong. It could be 20 years or it could be 2 years. Like, it's just hard to say. But that kind of brings us back to the Wi-Fi money or your business, right? If you're running a real life business too, an IRL business, any dollar you invest in your business is going to more than likely give you the best return, assuming that you're not incompetent at your business. So if you're actually good at it, any money you invest into it is going to far outperform the S&P 500, gold, Bitcoin, anything else, because that investment in yourself, whether it be in better equipment or better software, better hiring personal assistants, hiring employees, whatever the case is, expansion of your business is expansion of revenue. You're scaling yourself out with that money, and you're making every hour you spend more valuable.
Yeah, I agree. If you have some way to kind of diversify some of those risks, awesome. But investing in yourself, always the best investment that keeps yielding returns that you don't anticipate for years to come. There's a long tail to it and a lot of upside that's not directly obvious, which is, I think, what keeps a lot of people in the wage slave cycle. And they never realize what they've given up.
Yeah. All right. You got anything else you want to add on those subjects?
Homeownership is a lifestyle. The amount of money you spend on it is a lifestyle choice. Don't fall in the trap of thinking that just because it made your parents a lot of money, that's going to make you a lot of money. That could really turn upside down for you.
Yeah. You got to remember, the boomers bought houses that were built by the greatest generation, and those houses were very cheap. And then they rode that cheap real estate through to the current situation. They made their money on it, extracted that wealth. And now we have 8% interest rates and $500,000 homes.
Oh, there's one other point to consider is you're seeing the proliferation of really cheap building styles, right? So you see these 3D printed homes and such. Yeah, those may start off as like low end market things, but the cost of constructing a home should be dropping drastically. So if that's the case and they're able to build homes that don't look cheap or tacky, imagine what's going to happen to the value of your home separate from the land, right? The way technology works, it's astounding to me that houses are still this expensive. They should be getting a lot cheaper.
Well, and it's not just that they should be. Like, how is it possible that they've gotten more expensive to build when all the technology, you know, generally speaking, technology deflates the cost of things. You know, a cell phone today costs a tenth of what it would have cost, you know, 15, 20 years ago, as the technology gets better. But houses have somehow gone up to the extent that they can't even build a single family home and make a profit on it anymore. How is that possible that you can't build a small home and make money on it? You have to start at 2,500 square feet or higher. You know, 1,200 square foot home, not going to happen.
Yeah, mind blown. There's just so many things about a monopoly money economy that just make it hard to recognize what's going on. But you're exactly right. Home prices, well, the cost of construction of a home should benefit from deflation, technological deflation. I still consider land to be, at least if it's in a politically stable regime with good property rights and good rule of law, I consider land to be, you know, basically a form of hard money. So very different characteristic there. But if you're living on the outskirts of a major metropolitan area with just fields and fields of places to be annexed and suburbs to be developed, I wouldn't consider land to be a scarce resource there. So very, very possible to lose your ass there too.
Yeah, absolutely. So you got time to keep going?
Yeah, I got a few minutes.
Do you want to kind of talk some of your thoughts on VC Web 3.0? You know, fundraising and whatnot and some of the scams with that, or is that?
Yeah. And I can give a few teasers. Obviously this is a big topic and I don't want to, I got to be careful not to turn this into a rant session, but just basic overview is, anybody who's raising money right now for some sort of business, is running into this fact that like the traditional financial system just has utterly stopped to function as as an allocator of capital. Like, it's just ridiculous. If you're, you know, if you happen to have a business that's well suited to venture capital, okay, great. I'm not a big fan of it. I think there's many other places that your money or your, that are better suited for raising capital than venture capital. And I can go off on that next time, but just generally speaking, like getting a loan right now for any sort of real business, incredibly hard, incredibly tight credit conditions. And if you go to a commercial bank, they just seem so incredibly dysfunctional that it's not even worth doing. I can't tell you how many days it took to just get a basic equipment loan.
And for the average person who's not in their first time trying to do any kind of loan for a business, if it's outside the SBA, the Small Business Administration, it's not going to happen. Like most of your commercial banks, they won't even talk to you about a commercial loan if it's not SBA related. Some exceptions might be for commercial real estate and stuff, but if you're not already established in the space, if you're new to it, I mean, good luck doing anything outside that space.
Exactly right. Exactly right. It's mind blowing. You would think that banks, their job is to find good people to lend to. I have a couple quick thoughts on why that's happened. One obviously is banks are very skittish right now because they know how long the bull market's gone. They know what 2007, 2008 felt like. Banks sort of in their DNA know they fail all the time. They know they're fragile creatures and they'll lose. I think, what does Taleb say? They lose every dollar they ever make.
Yeah, pretty much.
And so they just, they're just amplifiers of the credit cycle. And so when they see something like this, where there's a lot of uncertainty in the near future, they get really skittish. And so I think they have zero appetite for lending, likely due to economic deterioration, geopolitical uncertainty, yield curve moves. But the second thing I've noticed is that they've cannibalized their relationship management. So they have very little real data on borrowers to sort out frauds, kooks, and zombies. So it's like mind-blowing in the era of big data, but it's true. There's very few long-standing banking relationships anymore. And those relationships are the way that qualitative credit info gets into the underwriter's hands and loyalty is established. So all that qualitative info is like the submerged part of the iceberg for the client profile of a commercial banking customer. And now they don't have any of that anymore, right? So they're just making these really blind credit decisions, and they've sort of come to realize that. And now they're trying to cover themselves because they realize that they're about to lose their ass.
Yeah, well, so all of that, plus just add in the overall theme of the 2020s that is going to be a competency crisis, right? In every industry, the people that are still there, essentially, all the competent people went and started their own businesses. So what you have left is people in these corporate things that, you know, in the banking specifically, they read off a spreadsheet. If X, then Y. If Y, then Z. If not X, you know, no Y. So they look at you and they're just checking boxes, and they don't actually understand your business model. They don't understand where the money is going, how you're going to turn it into more money. They have no comprehension of how business works. All they have is, you know, what is the spreadsheet that you're giving me in front of me? Does it have the right numbers that match my spreadsheet? That's it. They are you could train a monkey to do what they're doing and get the same results, get the same amount of loans processed.
Man, 100%. It's right on the money. It's literally a two brain cell sorting mechanism. Now it's underwriter makes a 30-second determination with zero value add, almost entirely done by computers, sorting on superficial metrics. So you've got real adverse selection because they're getting zombie companies whose operational stagnation has depleted most of the other financing avenues that they would have. And so banks are the only ones dumb enough to step in. You see this all the time with state and local banks. They get the real trash and lack the investment acumen necessary to fund a company's trajectory and future instead of its last 2 years of financials. So it's, yeah, good luck.
Also add into that the gift from the government of what's their ESG score. Do they check the right diversity boxes? Do they have enough women working for them? You know, are they going to help the environment? Are they all these things that have nothing to do with making money, which is the primary factor of a loan? Can you repay this loan? But there's all these additional factors that the government puts in there because, you know, because of our feelings and whatever else that needs to roll in. I mean, the entire ESG thing is starting to collapse as we speak, but there's still lending practices based off of those metrics.
Absolutely. And a good time to bring it back to our starting topic, which was real estate, right? So if you're thinking about how difficult it is to get money through the traditional financial system and how many problems you're going to have in the future with that, real estate sucks. Then what are you supposed to do? Like, if you still have a traditional business that needs cash or needs some sort of, you know, say, call it like near-term debt, the avenues that I've seen most promise in are like direct private money run by boutique shops, say with a solid brand and longstanding relationships. They're getting the best deal flow. They're the ones who can actually say, oh yeah, that's a creditworthy borrower. I don't know how they make it work in terms of their overhead and such, but they're doing really well. And they so far seem to be offering pretty decent terms. So at least on the debt side, from what I've seen right now, granted, I don't raise capital for like mid caps and large caps. So keep that in mind. But from what I'm seeing, it's a heyday for brokers who've banked all this relationship capital over the years that the commercial banks have hemorrhaged. So in my mind, that's the best use of your time right now for basic CapEx and working capital.
Okay. All right. That's probably going to be enough for tonight, because to go any further is going to be multiple hours. So I've kind of put a note in some of those things we can expand on in more detail in another episode.
Thanks for listening, everybody. Just a reminder that nothing we say here is to be considered financial advice. Remember, folks, nobody's going to save you. It is up to you to save yourselves. Have a good day.